The first thing I want to say is it's been such a blast to be part of this ITP, and I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to speak with people in small groups and hear the wonderful talks and everything. And I feel very fortunate to be able to present to you some work that my group's been doing on hydrophobically modified polymers that'll be part of a triple header this morning on telechelic polymers that have hydrophobic end groups. And my story began actually with a chance discussion with a colleague, Jeff Hubbell, who is active in tissue engineering. And he said, you know, Julie, we need materials that can be injected from a low viscosity state to form a variety of objects in the body that might have complicated shape or be larger than the opening you want to create them through and so on. And he said, especially there's a need for hydrogels that could be used for tissue engineering and drug delivery, especially the controlled release therapeutic proteins. And I said, well, you know, I love block copolymers and self-assembly and stuff. Why don't we use that kind of a motif and take a look for some hydrogels that form by physical association, which of course then you could disrupt, make an injectable state, and then form a gel, hopefully in a benign way, in the body. And now we have no signal. There we go, okay. I'll just twiddle this regularly. So the story that I'll tell you starts with the kind of molecules that we created, the phase behavior we have found, their rheology, their erosion kinetics, and then at the end I'll cover two biomedical applications of the material. So the challenge is to create a polymer that you can disperse to create a low viscosity state that could be used, for example, with suspended proteins injected into the body where it would spontaneously gel and allow controlled release of the therapeutic protein from the gel, or could be used as a soft support itself. And for that purpose, you'd like to have material properties that are stable for as long as the material exists. You want the polymer, the synthetic polymer, to disappear at the end. So it's transiently present in the body and then it disappears. But while it's there, you'd like it to have well-defined, stable, predictable properties like rates of diffusion, mechanical properties, and so on. So you'd prefer to have a material that exhibits what's called surface erosion. It disappears from its surface. The material that is there has stable properties the whole time, instead of sort of swelling and falling apart. And the previously described hydrogels are of this type. So we were hoping to find, based on polymer physics, materials that would do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll try and remember to stand up here. When I'm sitting in your seat, I remember, but not when I'm standing up here. So we decided to build on the copious literature on associative polymers, especially hydrophobically modified PEG. PEG is a polymer that's well accepted for use in the human body. And as I'll show you, fluoroalkyls are also well tolerated by the human body. So we decided to take a look at hydrophobically modified polymers. There's already a substantial literature on these materials because they're used in everything from cosmetics to drilling mud, and they're called associative thickeners. And in particular, alkyl-ended PEGs are extensively used and extensively studied. The materials that had been described up to the time we began our work were all of a single-phase type. That means as you increase the concentration, you start out with at very, very low concentration dissociated molecules, then you form micelles, but the micelles aren't connected. As you increase concentration, the probability of having cores, hydrophobic aggregates, that are close enough together to bridge goes up, and bridges form, you have clusters floating around, and then as the probability of those clusters being close together grows, they associate with each other in a variety of ways, having little pendant loops, multiple hydrophobic cores aggregated into daisy chains, which then connect into a network. And when this type of structure starts percolating, you see big enhancements of the viscosity. And ultimately, at very high concentration, where the micelle, the core-core distance is uniformly small, then you expect to have extensive direct bridging, and this concept of superbridges is no longer pertinent. The materials show continuous behavior as a function of increasing concentration. If you implanted this in the body, it would just retrace the way back, and obviously it would undergo bulk erosion. We didn't want that. But there was a prediction already in the literature that we should be able to find equilibrium coexistence behavior, which would give you surface erosion. Semenov predicted that isolated micelles that are too far apart to form these bridges have limited entropy, configurational entropy of their end groups. Energy is not a big issue because the hydrophobes are sufficiently hydrophobic that they're essentially always inside an aggregate. So they always get that free energy. But the entropy benefits from having lots of possible ways you can configure those ends. And that provides a thermodynamic driving force for forming a dense phase. And although at the time we began the work, this hadn't been observed, this has since been observed in alkyl-ended and fluoroalkyl-ended PEGs. And so that was what inspired us to go and take a look. And where we decided to look was, again, dictated by what's accepted for use in the human body. Polyethylene glycol is widely used and accepted. And fluoroalkyl groups, actually, I didn't know this, are more biocompatible than alkyl groups. And there are two hypotheses for that. One is they're more chemically inert. Another is that they're both lipophobic and hydrophobic. So they don't mess around with cell membranes and things like that. The real reason is not known, but what is known is it just comes out in your urine and it doesn't seem to do much harm. So those were the building blocks we picked to look at. From a polymer physics point of view, it's also nice that fluoroalkyls are more hydrophobic than regular alkyls, making it more likely that we might access the sol-gel equilibrium behavior. So I'll tell you the story of the observed phase behavior as a function of PEG length and fluoroalkyl length, the rheology, the erosion behavior, a strategy for doing this transformation from a low viscosity state to a high viscosity state, preliminary results for using this for controlled release of human growth hormone, and then, if I haven't totally exhausted my time, I'll also show that these are really great polymers for doing surface modification of Teflon surfaces, which is also biomedically relevant. So, what my student Guillaume did is he varied the PEG length from 6,000 to 20,000, and the fluoroalkyl length from C6 to C10. And the full hydrophobe consists of this fluoroalkyl piece, a two-carbon alkyl piece, and isofurone diisocyanate linker. But it appears to be very heavily dominated by fluoroalkyls, even in the presence of these groups. What he found was that for sufficiently long PEG, he observed the single phase behavior that had been extensively observed before. So that was the Annabelle picture of these things progressively bridging with continuous behavior as a function of concentration. If the PEG length was short enough and the fluoroalkyls long enough, he observed the anticipated sol-gel equilibrium coexistence behavior. And the equilibrium gel concentration was predominantly controlled by the length of the PEG. Two different samples with the same PEG length have essentially the same equilibrium gel concentration. You shorten the PEG, you make a more dense gel. It acts just qualitatively the way you would expect the molecular weight between crosslinks to act.
Julie, can you just explain, you mentioned the 20K is the length of the PEG.
Right.
It's 20K diamonds or
something. Is that right. So this would be, yeah. Is that clear to everybody? Okay. And the sol concentration, first off, it was very low compared to what people had observed in Russell's group. They had, in parallel with our work, been looking at alkyl-ended systems that did exhibit sol-gel equilibrium and showed much higher sol concentrations. And the sol concentration was very sensitive to fluoroalkyl length. So you can see it goes down substantially if you increase the length of the fluoroalkyl. And then for applications of the body, it's interesting to know what salts do. They shift it in the way you'd expect. Salt acts like a precipitant for PEG, but I won't go into all that. The materials that exhibit, oh yeah, right, there is something here that I will come back to. If the PEG is sufficiently short and the fluoroalkyl sufficiently long, it swells with water, but we were not able to detect anything in the sol phase, so we refer to that as insoluble. But just have the image in your mind, it forms a gel, swells with water, but we just couldn't detect anything in the sol. The single phase materials behave in accord with the prior literature on associative thickeners. The relaxation time slows, the modulus increases, everything's continuous as you build up concentration. Yeah, I probably will skip over this in the interest of time. I can come back to that if you'd like. If you look at the gel phase at the equilibrium gel composition for the materials that exhibit equilibrium coexistence of solid gel, they also show similar characteristics, nearly single relaxation time behavior. The modulus increases as you make the peg length shorter. Again, it acts just like making the molecular weight between cross links shorter and is in accord with what we saw in terms of the effect of peg length on the equilibrium concentration of the gel. If you make the fluoroalkyl longer, you slow the relaxation time. And I'll come back to this later in the talk. So if you can remember, increasing from a C8 fluoroalkyl to a C10 produced a 30-fold slowing down of the relaxation time.
I know why biologists would call that a gel, but I'm not sure I would.
That's fine. Yeah. A rheologist would call it a single relaxation time fluid, or nearly single. And
yeah, so
here
it's really viscoelastic free.
Yeah.
So in fact, it's for that, it's not except the value of the characteristic time is very different from semi-diluted solution of polymer.
From a semi-diluted, right. Okay.
Except the value of the characteristic time. Eventually.
Yeah, so these relaxation times are long, and then also the fact that if you put it in an open system, unlike a solution, this won't fall apart.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's nearly single relaxation time behavior, you know, slopes nearly 1 and 1 over here. There's a semicircle and a Col-Col plot. It's not far from that. We can go into that more. So,
yes. I'm sorry. So you say, when you put it with excess water, it doesn't fall apart, which means that you are in fact in this two-phase equilibrium.
Correct. These three polymers all are in the category that exhibits equilibrium coexistence.
Okay, it's because there is this equilibrium between two phases that you have a concentrated phase all the time.
Yeah.
And now if you add something like, I don't know, surfactant or something like that,
eventually
it will
That's the game we want to play. Okay. I'll show you.
What have you measured with the rheology? Have you measured, is that the coexisting?
So this is right at or very slightly above the equilibrium gel concentration. So each of these is at a different concentration, just at or just a little bit above. So it's nicely single phase. What was in
the
right? Right. Yeah, but right close to it. And I'll show you that interesting stuff happens as you go a little bit higher.
And it's all in the vicinity of 10%, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so you recall from the table that for the ones that had 10,000, it was around 6.5, 6.8%, and for 6K, it was around 10%, okay? So in accord with the prior literature on associative thickeners, the behavior is nearly single exponential. We did not see a shear thickening regime. We saw the strong shear thinning, as in prior literature. Strong concentration dependence of the viscosity associated for the single phase materials with both the increase in the height of this plateau and the increase in the relaxation time with concentration. Now, interesting things that caught our attention. One is, if you look at the plateau modulus normalized by NKT, in associative thickeners, values below 1 are consistently found. There are a few reports with values greater than 1, but generally the values are some fraction of NKT. All of the systems that showed
N is what is the number of
chains, number of chains per unit volume. Yeah, and the systems that showed sol-gel equilibrium coexistence also consistently showed moduli that were higher than NKT. We thought that was interesting, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And then over here, this just illustrates what I mentioned before, that the relaxation time is predominantly controlled by the fluoroalkyl ends and very insensitive to the length of the peg. So what happens if you go to a little bit higher concentration? So here's the terminal behavior in the storage modulus at a concentration a little bit above the equilibrium gel concentration. You go a little bit higher, and bam, you get this low-frequency plateau. And we have a limited temperature range because water boils, but you can do a little bit, and you can show that this extends for at least 4 decades. And then we run out of the ability to play time-temperature superposition games. You go to higher concentration, the plateau goes up. So somebody...
Those curves are not using time temperature superposition.
No, this is all at one temperature. This is at 25 degrees. I can show you that other data if you want.
Just
checking. Yeah. So, you know, for somebody who plays with block of polymers, like, oh, cool, Guillaume, you found an ordering transition. So he went and did, neutron scattering in collaboration with Yatsan Alal at Argonne. And sure enough, as you go up in concentration, you get a sharpening of the peak, and you pick up higher order peaks that are at root 2 and root 3, which could be either BCC or simple cubic. We attribute it to BCC in part because of the, what? Yeah, I'll show those of you who want, you know. Yeah. No. I put them all on top of each other. Shame on me. And I tried to fix this, but yesterday was just a crazy day, so I didn't have any chance. So, but for a manuscript, I have figures that are separated with little arrows, and you can see the peaks. So please come see me with a ruler, and we'll go over.
But yeah, more importantly than the fact that you see higher order peak, mm-hmm. the real indication that you have long range order is coming from the width of the first order peak. You may have seen.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
right. This will come up later.
You don't really need a higher order peak. There are many systems.
Right.
I mean, with neutron scattering to see structure, you can. I can show you a picture where you have a structure factor of a liquid, a structure factor of a solid, a cubic phase.
Either of those is evidence for long range order.
Yes.
But there are certainly systems with long range order which do not have higher order peaks.
Absolutely.
Because they have perfectly harmonic sinusoidal
undulations. Well, and also setting this discussion to the side, the other thing that was troubling to us about not getting higher order peaks, if you didn't get them, is you can't assign which structure it is.
Sure.
And we wanted to be able to get aggregation numbers out.
It could be a glass.
Although I don't know if a glass would give such... Anyway, so for the purpose of today's discussion, let us note that the peak did get higher, did get narrower, and we did get higher order peaks, and they were root 2 and root 3. Okay, so no matter what criteria you like to use, I think we can satisfy you that it ordered into a cubic phase. It could be BCC, it could be simple cubic. The literature says it's not simple cubic, so we assign BCC. And from that, we determine the aggregation number from the known number of chains per unit volume that are present and the unit cell size, okay? And what we find is that also for analogs that were synthesized with a single end, so this is monofunctional 5KC8, so that's like cutting this one in half, monofunctional 5KC10, that's like cutting this one in half. Those you can dilute, okay? And you can see that the results that you get for the aggregate size also give aggregation numbers that are in accord with the ones that you see in the ordered phase of the telehelix. Right, so...
coming back to that, mm-hmm. The 12%, how is it associated with the... the appearance of the plateau.
No, you do not. So this assignment here is based just on having a first order peak. This does not have higher order peaks, and it does not have this low frequency plateau. These two, and I would have to check Guillaume's data. This one, actually, I think he had very great difficulty getting rheology on it. It is highly elastic, so it must have a plateau, but it was very difficult to get good data. And as I was talking to Jean-Francois, the stuff cracks. It's a very delicate thing to handle, and it takes a very long time to heal. So I don't think we have rheology on this, but it obviously has an elastic plateau. So do these...
Basically, you associate the appearance of the plateau with the appearance of the long range order.
The additional plateau. So you have a high-frequency plateau up here, and that relaxation time is attributed to how these end groups let go of the aggregates they're in. Then if you order, you have that plateau plus another one, and they're just slightly different. The inflection doesn't move much. And then this long plateau, we believe, would be the hopping time for a whole micelle hopping in the lattice, which is orders of magnitude slower. Right. And so one of the things I wanted to get at here is you look at everything that has C8 on the ends, and irrespective of whether it's a monofunctional dilute solution or a telechelic over a range of concentration, they all give the same number. It's about 30. Okay. If you look at everything that's got C10 on it, similarly, all of them are about 50. Okay. So the aggregation numbers are big. They are sensitive to the fluoroalkyl length, and they are not sensitive to concentration and are not sensitive to peg length. Okay. So what are the implications? Well, one thing that we see in the rheology of the systems that show this continuous behavior is a sign that micelle-micelle packing, which is manifestly evident in an ordering transition, is even evident in the single-phase systems. Their modulus is actually too high to explain, given that the ratio of bridges to loops should not, there's no system in which it's ever been observed to exceed a half. So when you see NKT, you have to divide that by a half. That's the maximum number that are actually making bridges. So as soon as you see a modulus that exceeds one half NKT, there has to be some additional physics, okay? And there has not previously been an explanation for that. In view of this ordering transition, we believe there's micelle-micelle repulsion going on even in those systems. They're at concentrations not too different from where you see ordering. So how could it be negligible, right? So that's my personal belief. And the other thing is, in Annibal's model, he allows the bridge-to-loop ratio to exceed a half, or, well, exceed 1:1, as soon as the distance between micelle cores comes within the range of 1RG. He immediately allows it to go to something like 75%. And I think that the model could be greatly improved by a more accurate description of the bridge-to-loop ratio and inclusion of micelle-micelle repulsion. In terms of the phase behavior, both Semenov's model and an extension of it, or a variation on it by Russell, assume that the phase behavior is completely determined by the aggregation number, because that's what governs how much entropic benefit you get from being able to shuffle from one core, which is all you have if you're isolated, to many different available cores if you're in a dense state. They predict that the peg length has no effect, and it's because of a cancellation of the fact that if you make the peg longer, the outermost blobs are softer. So you would say, oh, that makes the repulsion go down. But the area over which they have contact goes up, and those are predicted to exactly cancel each other. Here's what happens. These two graphs, there's no known way to put these things on a phase diagram. What they illustrate is, as a function of peg length and concentration of polymer, what your phase behavior looks like. This one up here has aggregation numbers of 30. This one down here has aggregation numbers of 50. Semenov and Russell say these should look very different from each other, and the first thing you notice is they don't. Semenov and Russell say, as I change peg length, I shouldn't change whether it's single phase or precipitate or sol-gel equilibrium. And it does, big time. You change from 6,000 to 10,000 to 20,000, and it totally changes the phase behavior. So I would say that there's a need for a better understanding of the effect of the peg chain length. And especially, I believe it's entering through changing the micelle-micelle repulsion in a way that's not currently understood.
And the trend is clear, right? If you sit underneath this, there's a tendency to order into some sort of lattice.
So that's these solid symbols up here, the ordering, yeah.
Yeah, but then you're saying that's the nature of the micelle-micelle repulsion, and that's going to be much enhanced if the connecting chain is reduced in size compared to the size of the core.
Mm-hmm.
So that at least
yes.
Is, but I agree it isn't quantitative.
Right, and in particular, the current sort of hand-waving treatment in Semenov and Russell says that to the current way things are viewed, the softening of the repulsion at the outermost is exactly offset by the increase in area. And that clearly is not true, and I can tell you my pet theory. My pet theory is that they base that on assuming that for all the peg lengths you're looking at, or all the corona polymer lengths you're looking at, you are either in the stretched brush regime, kind of crew cut kind of regime, or you're in the soft brush regime. And if you're fully in either one of those regimes, then this cancellation works. But nobody has attempted, and maybe it's because I'm not sure if there is a theoretical framework that would allow you to bridge, nobody's looked in between. And it's my belief that you are crossing that from 6,000 to 20,000. And that's why you're not seeing the simple scaling.
Yeah.
Can you remind how long is the chain?
Okay, so the you know, this label here is 5,000, so there's samples we have are at 6,000, 10,000, and 20,000 molecular weight for the PEG. And these two are, each chart has fixed hydrophobe length, so these are all at fixed aggregation number. And it's just to bring home the point that you change aggregation number a lot, from 30 to 50, and look how similar these are. Okay, so to say that aggregation number is the main dial to turn is not right. And to say that the PEG length does not enter is really wrong. You know, if you look at the effect of PEG length, it's very strong. I mean, for me, you know, 6,000 to 10,000 is not a big change in PEG length. 10 to 20 is not a big change, but it radically changes the phase behavior. So.
Julia, does it exist data on the same system but with dye blocks? Something like that, half the PEG and the same chain with dye blocks, especially in regard to the BCC.
Oh yes, there is data on that, but I don't remember it. Yeah, can you answer that? Yeah.
Because I do expect that for the, I don't know how much it will be different, but I do expect that for the, in the order,
correct.
The biology will not be very different.
Ooh, there, I think it does turn out to be very different, because actually if, I think the position of the ordering transition is probably not too different. If you make the dye block analog, it's micelle-micelle packing.
Okay.
So I think the ordering won't change very much. But now imagine I'm in a cubic phase in which all I have to do to hop is just hop. All I have is my activation barrier is squeezing between my neighbors. Now imagine you've got 15 legs tying you down. So you have an aggregation number of 30, and you have to let go of 15 legs simultaneously in order to hop. Oh, it's going to be a lot slower.
I'm not sure that the process, the microscopic process, of is really hopping of one micelle.
Oh, right, right, right,
depends what, how you,
right,
you
right. But if it's sliding of layers, you're even more dead.
Nevertheless, yeah. I'd like to see whether the gene fragment
yes. Yeah. Oh, I can tell you, Guillaume couldn't measure it.
It is.
Have you?
Well, I expect you
it flows. I mean, that stuff.
You get the same what? Sort of model.
Yeah, but the frequency is out of the range of our instrument. We can't see it.
I don't have the order phase. Yeah. I mean,
Right.
I expect it different, but.
Right. So what happens is your time scale shifts out of the range that you can access experimentally. I mean, maybe if we were clever and enhanced the viscosity instead of using water as the medium or something.
Yeah, I'm talking about the G prime value.
Yeah, but I can't measure it because it's already relaxed by the highest frequency my instrument can do. So I bet it has a modulus that's about the same. And I can tell you more why I think it's about the same. So if we go back to this. Suppose that half of this is due to bridges. And actually, I would say the upper limit of what you can attribute to bridges is this. 1/2 NKT. All the rest is due to micelle-micelle repulsion, in my humble opinion. And therefore, if I could do that experiment by using an ultrasonic probe or something, I predict you would see 75% of this modulus in the monofunctional changes. Yeah, but I can't do anything about it. I can only talk. So now, do these materials work the way that physics would say they do? And of course they do. If you have a material that exhibits sol-gel equilibrium, it erodes like this. And as I'll show you, you can dial in that erosion rate over a very wide range, which is very attractive from practical applications point of view. And materials that exhibit a continuous single phase transition erode like this. In addition, I'll show in the next slide, you can create these ordered phases of monofunctional micelles and watch them erode, and of course they just swell and diffuse away also. So we collaborated with Dietelm Johansman and Mietz, the Max Planck for polymers, where they have an apparatus that allows you to do surface plasmon resonance in contact with a flowing water stream. So you start out with a glass slide with a layer of gold, and you deposit by spin coating your polymer. So for example, I'll show you an example here where you spin coat 10KC8 polymer. The dry thickness is half a micron. And then you start doing your surface plasma measurement, looking at the resonance angle, and then introduce water and observe how that resonance angle shifts with time to get information about the local concentration of polymer, which will be manifested in the refractive index. And if the sample gets thin enough, it'll also be dependent on the thickness of the sample. So here you see a characteristic resonance angle before introducing the water that's characteristic of the high refractive index of the dry film. You introduce water, it swells, and in fact it overshoots. So you start out with a half micron thick film. It swells to roughly 10 times that thickness. And that's much too thick, actually, for the thickness to affect the surface plasma and resonance anymore. So you're mainly getting information about the local concentration, which enters through the refractive index. So it overshoots, and over a period of several minutes, notice the times here are shown in hours, it reaches equilibrium. So we thought that was really weird. And I'd happily talk to people about that. It reaches an equilibrium state, and then the concentration in the gel remains constant over a period of days. And finally, the film gets thin enough that you see the thickness dropping as the film disappears. And so we can use this duration of time to compute the rate at which the polymer was eroding. So first off, from the structure of this, you can see right away that it is surface erosion, and the fact that if you increase the thickness, you linearly increase this time. All that's consistent with its surface erosion for the systems that exhibit sol-gel equilibrium. And Guillaume also did analogous experiments, the best analog that he could. I can tell you about the conditions he picked and why. For a lyotropic gel of 5KC10, so this is again the analog of the telechelic with 10,000 cut in half. And it undergoes this ordering into a cubic phase that's referred to as a lyotropic gel. And you place that in contact with water, and it very rapidly swells and disappears. Basically, it happens so fast that you just compute the total time for it to disappear and use that to estimate the rate at which it was dissolving. Similarly, for a single-phase type system with 20,000 molecular weight telechelic, they both erode very quickly, and it's so fast that you can't tell whether there's a plateau or not. You're just relying on physics to tell you that it's homogeneously swelling and falling apart. The ones that exhibit sol-gel equilibrium, they're the ones that all show this, very consistently shows very long time plateau that grows linearly with thickness for the ones that we can measure. Interestingly, this one erodes so slowly that for the thinnest film we looked at, it lived for days and days and days. I think he studied it for 5 days and could not observe any change, so he stopped and went on to something else. So too slow to measure, he was able to put a bound on that. It's at least 100 times slower than this one. Okay, so you notice that you can tune things by an order of magnitude just by changing peg length at fixed fluoroalkyl, and by changing fluoroalkyl length, you can tune them by at least two orders of magnitude more. Interestingly, what did we see in the rheology? Rheology said your time scale shifts by a factor of 30. We know that this is slower by at least a factor of 100. How come? Well, how do you think things lead from the surface? Again, if you have an aggregation number of 30, you already have 15 legs you have to let go of in order to float away as a micelle. If you have 50, aggregation numbers of 50, you've got 25 legs that have to simultaneously let go. And it's true that for each letting go event, this one is 30 times slower. But think how many more legs you have to release. It's raised to some power. You know, we don't even know how slow it is. It's so slow. So the good news for biotechnology means you've got all kinds of knobs to turn, and you can tune this over a very wide range, which is nice. Yes. We did not do that because we wanted this to be, if you're a chemical engineer and you do these transport problems, if you hold the flow field exactly the same, then you can make comparisons based on the equilibrium sol concentration. Okay, and so for example, for these two, their relative rates of erosion do accord with their equilibrium sol concentrations. These do not, which suggests that these ones are letting go often enough that they maintain at their surface the equilibrium sol concentration. These guys let go so slowly that it suggests that even the very low equilibrium sol that we observed is not maintained at their surface.
Flow rates are just to be comparable to what we have in our
blood. That was the case, but it's coincidental. Yes, we did not plan ahead. I'll show you another experiment where we did pay attention to that, but stay tuned. Am I totally abusing your time? I've already gone over the 10:30 mark. Okay, so you guys have memorized everything I just said, so I won't summarize. So very quickly, I just want to tell you two snippets on using this stuff for biomedical applications. My student came into me one day, Gyeong, and he said, did you know that there are certain organic solvents that are approved for use in the human body? And I said, you've got to be kidding! And he said, one of them happens to be N-methylpyrrolidone, which is a great solvent for the PEG part and the fluoroalkyl part of my polymer. I was like, great, go for it, you wild man, because I had been sending him barking up all wrong trees with using cyclodextrins to complex the fluoroalkyls and enzymes to degrade them off and all kinds of things that didn't work. Anyway, so he said, well, why don't I see if I can make an injectable solution, okay? And water, NMP will diffuse out, and water will diffuse in. And to put this in perspective, NMP is not, it shows no sign of toxicity, even at levels of milligrams per kilo of body weight. And 50 microliters of this would be enough to give you a month's worth of human growth hormone. Okay? So you really, this is a great game to play. Right. So he discovered that even at 50% polymer concentration, this stuff is a low enough viscosity to be injectable, and that after the NMP diffuses out, you recover fully the properties that you would get, the rheological properties, as if it had just been hydrated from the dry state in water. So NMP would much rather be in water than the fluoroalkyl hydrophobic environment. It's like, oh, Gyeong, you're so clever. So off to the races. We met with Jeff and said, well, what should we go after first? And we discussed various options and decided to go after an example that illustrates controlled release of a therapeutic protein, and in particular one that there is no existing controlled release strategy that works. And that's human growth hormone. Kids get it injected every day for many years. Yuck. Wouldn't it be great if they could be injected once a month? So the idea we had is that you create an injectable suspension of precipitated human growth hormone particles and your polymer in NMP, inject it, NMP diffuses out, water diffuses in a fairly short time, you know, it appears to be a minute or less, you set up the gel. And since these are precipitated particles, their diffusivity is not large, they don't go anywhere, and you trap them. And then they slowly dissolve and diffuse out of the gel, and then the gel ultimately also just dissolves away. But that appears to be on a longer time scale, we found out. So we did a little in vitro experiment where we have this suspension in NMP injected into water. The NMP diffuses out, the water diffuses in, it sets up a gel. You remove the supernatant at intervals and analyze it for human growth hormone, and you find that it shows a very attractive release profile with no initial burst and no denaturation of the protein. Other systems show a very large amount of irreversible aggregation, which would show up over here. This is an active monomeric standard human growth hormone, and you can see that we maintain that. Since then, we've collaborated with a company called Infamed, which is one of Jeff's, you know, half dozen startup companies. Anyway, they've done some rat experiments and they gain weight on this stuff even if they're knocked out for making growth hormone. So
what's the danger?
So 2, 6, 9, just to show that over time as you're releasing it, you're releasing active monomeric form. You don't want to be...
That's the time when, before you inject?
No. This is for the in vitro experiment. So I create this gel at time zero. And I remove the supernatant at intervals over a period of 30 days. And you do see sustained release for 30 days, and the time scale is controlled by the length scale, and it's, you know, governed by the diffusion.
And the T in minutes long bottom is after removal of the supernatant, is that right?
Oh, this is elution time. I'm sorry. This graph here is showing the amount of protein released, the fraction, it's not percent, so that would be 100% up there, plotted versus square root of time. It's roughly linear versus square root of time, so it appears to be controlled by the rate of diffusion of the protein molecules through the gel. And key things there are that there's no initial burst and sustained release over a period of weeks. This one here is actually an elution curve. And if irreversible aggregates formed, they would elute earlier. And we have also done experiments where you do see irreversible aggregates, and they're quite unmistakable. And as a chemical engineer, I thought, ooh, irreversible aggregates, that's got to be bad because you're wasting your most valuable ingredient. Jeff said, oh, it's much worse than that. They're a foreign protein now, and you get an immunological response. So you're injecting poison if you do that. And the existing proposed approaches do that. They have a very big problem with initial burst and irreversible aggregates forming. So, and then the other potential application that we're playing around with is looking at ways that you can functionalize Teflon surfaces like pacemakers. All kinds of things are encapsulated in Teflon. But there are various problems that occur because of the cascade of events that begins with protein adsorption on Teflon, which can cause blood clots to form, which can break free and go to your brain and bad things happen. So these polymers are really cool because especially the ones that don't show any measurable concentration in the sol phase, they ought to form very long-lived PEG layers. And it's a real bear to covalently modify Teflon. I mean, people do it, but it's a real bear to do it. So one of the things that Gyung did is he showed that you can just take a Teflon part, dip it into an ethanol solution, so it's also sterilized for free. That also seems to be the case with the NMP. You dip your part into an ethanol solution of fluoroalkane and PEG, pull it out. You know, just from the viscous flow, you're left behind with a viscous film of this stuff on the part. You dip it in water. It sets up a gel. It anchors to the surface. It lasts a long time, and then it will stop. So, for example, if you look at the, we did capillary rise experiments. Over a period of weeks, you can't even measure the decrease at stresses that are typical in most blood vessels in your body. This would be the upper limit of the stress in the arc of your aorta. And there, he believes that the erosion is, in fact, due to a mechanical thing. The pump that he used for generating these high flow rates actually introduced a lot of mechanical shock. Anyway, so with that, I will stop. I'd like to thank, of course, Jeff for being co-advisor. Gyung, all of this was done by one student. And Theo Hoganesh, who's down the road from us at USC, who helped us get started with synthesis. Gitalm and Yotsana for helping with the surface plasmon resonance and SANS. And thank you so much for letting me be part of the ITP and to talk to you guys today. Yeah, and Jeff thinks it's going to be a killer patent, too, because he said, you know, when we did preliminary animal experiments, he said the site where these polymers are introduced is so quiet, it's qualitatively different than the other approaches out there. You mix two reactive streams and they form a gel inside, but then, of course, they covalently react with all the biomolecules that are around also, right? Then there are ones where you use UV light to cause it to react in situ, and those also have all kinds of side reactions because you're generating radicals, okay? And then the other ones is the injectable formulation that's been proposed is using polylactic acid, and as it degrades, it creates very, very low pH, pH of 2 at the site, and you get all kinds of inflammation, right? So Jeff thinks this is going to be a really... that's right, the nearby tissue solvates. So,
but the fact is that this polylactic is the one which is used right now for all kind of peptide and protein to have very well.
No, that's the thing is if you talk to somebody like Jeff, he says it is used and it's not nice. It's not nice
okay,
stuff.
But if you have a problem with the growth hormone that it doesn't go with the polylactic system, you don't get a good association and you have a problem of making the sample.
Correct, yeah. The processing strategy there is the main culprit in forming these irreversible aggregates.
Yeah.
But in addition, they also have a big initial burst. And my belief is that, you know, if you have a strategy that's based on encapsulation, any capsules that have a crack, they all release on the first day. And it's very hard to really bring that down.
There are two issues with the growth hormone. One is what you say, which is to have a long-lasting delivery system. But there is another one which is quite interesting too. It's the fact that depending when you inject the people, the reaction may be very different because you have cycles of over hours in your body. And depending whether you inject at such time or another time, the response you have is not the same. Right. So when you do trials, what happens is that in this case, you have a part of the population, like 50%, let's say, which is not responding, not because they don't respond, just because statistically you did not inject that at the right time. So if you just can just a little bit control the time over this will be released, and in this case, eventually, you get a much better statistical response.
Yeah, I'll ask Jeff about that too. So this strategy would not have diurnal cycles to it, but it might still behave better because at least it's consistent over 24 hours. But it's true that if you're trying to mimic what the human body actually does, especially pre-adolescence, there is a very strong diurnal cycle. But I don't have a strategy for that, so I'll just not talk about
So, I would try to be short. I have one microphone here, but I will try to be short and to emphasize one particular point in the rheology or rheophysics of transient network made from telechelic polymers Julia spoke about. This is a thesis of Yael Serrero, and this is a collaboration with three chemists from Montpellier who synthesized the polymers. Our point of view was the one from coming from the worm-like micelles. We want to have another system different from worm-like micelles, which apparently is simple in terms of linear rheology and apparently has a promising non-linear rheological properties. And because of this collaboration, and due to this collaboration, we went to a system which is actually very, very similar to the one Julia talked about. It is a telechelic system with PEO, polyethylene oxide, as a middle chain. And we have also some fluorinated hydroforms. But contrary to Julia, we don't have here two CH2, but 10. So it's a longer hydrophobic group, so we expect a stronger effect in the formation of the networks. And we have used different chemistry, and these different chemistry are here written, so it's very strange names. These strange names correspond to different polymers, with typically a 10K or 20K molecular weight middle chain, and with N caps, N spacer, I don't enter into details. The important thing there is this: all these polymers are giving networks, are giving the thing you presented, with very different relaxation time. So there is also one important point that should be mentioned and maybe to be added to what you said. If you take these polymers and you put them in water, as predicted by Semenov, and investigated further by Russell, they are showing a phase separation. This phase separation is well understood in terms of an effective attractive potential due to the bridging, okay? In fact, if because of the synthesis, you are losing some of these N-caps, so you have 10% of polymers which are not double N-capped, you lose the phase separation. The effective attractive potential is not strong enough, and so you get a particle, which is a micelles, a flower-like micelles, which will not phase separate into the gel and liquid phase, as Julia spoke about. Okay, and this is the case we had. Actually, our polymers were less well characterized, but they were less synthesized. So we have something like 10% or 20% of the polymers which we are not fully double end capped. And in this case, we never observed phase separation. when we succeed to make 100% NCAP polymers, we do observe phase separation.
So what is the how many unperfect molecules you need to
10%.
10%
is enough to
yeah.
And maybe I will say a word about why I mean some unwavering argument.
And this is understood or not, why 10% is only is enough to
The way I like very much and the way that Julia, I mean, I agree fully with Julia, is the way Russell described it in this paper. You can consider the micelles. Let me show you instead of speaking. This is a picture, only a picture, okay? These double N-cap polymers are forming such a flower-like micelles where there is a core of everything which is hydrophobic and where there is a corona. And this corona is special because it is made of loops, okay? And there is a given aggregation number. Here, she spoke about 30 or 50. We have the same numbers, okay? And so you have some structure in the corona with a description in terms of blobs for the polymers, which are, in this case, slightly stretched, okay? If you imagine that you have 10% of the polymer which are not double end-capped, they are going that way, they are attached here, and here you have an additional radius of duration of 5K or something like that, which is actually playing the role of increasing the repulsion between the corona. I don't know if I'm clear.
It increases polydispersity of
and it decreases a little bit the polydispersity.
And then it destroys bulk ratio.
Not long run. Strong phase separation, exactly.
Well?
No, of course not. Otherwise, we would not be have been so interested with this data, with this system.
Excuse me interrupting, but for those of us who are not expert on these systems, could you just define aggregation number? I meant to ask Julie this question. Just tell us, how do you define the aggregation number?
Oof, I have made a very, very sophisticated fits. You have several ways to define the aggregation number. You can look at a light scattering experiment.
Not to measure it, to define.
Not
measure it.
Oh, I'm sorry. To define?
Yeah, what is it?
Yeah, so for example, in the talk I just gave, it's the number of fluorialkyls on average in one hydrophobic core.
Right.
Yeah.
Some people actually, like Russell, he uses something you divide by two. He would say the number of chains participating.
Okay, your numbers were.
Of fluoroalkyls in the.
Okay, so we have
the
using
the 16 chains.
So you were right to ask the question.
No. The aggregation number for me is the number of polymers which is in one aggregate.
Sorry.
The important thing is to observe that these polymers aggregate into flower-like
mass.
Right.
Yeah.
But your actual number is
30 to 50. But it is the number of polymers. So we have 100. One. Well. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that would make sense too because that.
The hydrophobic is strong.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I'd like to write down the number. what was the number you just said for your aggregation?
50. So we have 100. 50 chains where we have 100 end caps in the core. So I wanted to go fast, but. The interesting part of this system, or the interesting property of this system, which I liked very much from the very first beginning, is that there resembles Maxwellian fluid at over a broad range of concentration, over a broad range of different polymers. We apply step strain experiment, which consists of, and we measure the stress relaxation function for two different, you remember these two strange names, forget what the chemistry is, but look at the relaxation time, 0.6 seconds, 50 seconds. These two things, these two fluids, look like gels. They are not flowing. You return they are viscoelastic fluid, okay? With a given elastic modulus and a given relaxation time.
But long times.
And these times, fortunately for us, can be very long. And by playing on the chemistry, I like this picture because it is a four system I showed you before. This is a relaxation time as function of concentration. But what is important here is to see that we can range over 1 millisecond, typically, to 100 seconds by choosing adequately one system with respect to the other.
Do you have charges on this?
No charges. Everything is neutral. And we have used this property, actually, we choose the polymers for the purpose we wanted to.
Just to get an idea, what would be the reputation time of the hydrophilic part alone?
It is a 10K polymer.
It's really milliseconds, even for the reputation time.
I mean, I would not say that we are never in a reputation regime.
No, I understand, but I want just to have that.
I can add something. We are at a concentration which is below the C star of the single non-NCAP polymer.
Okay.
Which is about 4 to 8%. So we don't have. So the picture you should have in mind is a core, a corona made of loops. And this is to go in the direction of what you were asking, Didier, just before. This is here the comparison between diblocks and telekelics. Mm-hmm. The diblocks being twice shorter than the telekelics. So it's if we have cut the telekelics into two parts. This is neutron scattering. This is a form factor. This is a 10K. This is a 5K. And you see the form factor are very similar. Okay, there is a multiplicating factor because they overlap otherwise. They have the same shape, even if this shape is difficult to fit and so on. This is a form factor at low concentration of these aggregates. So these aggregates made of diblock and triblock are the same in terms of form factor. This is a structure factor.
What's the concentration?
This is 0.5%, this is 4%, this is 8%. This is a structure factor which gives you the interaction between the particles. The interaction or the structure factor for the diblock and the triblock at 4% as 8% are more or less the same. You can see a difference here. That the tri-block actually has a less strong repulsion. Okay? But you see the position of these maxima are identical. And now I compare the viscosity of these two systems. The viscosity of the di-block is a Newtonian fluid.
And so why your S of Q why is it going back to zero at Q equals zero? It's a liquid, so you should have a finite value of S of Q for Q equals zero.
Here you mean?
But the bottom curves.
It's going to zero.
It should not, if it's a liquid.
Well,
okay, it's very low.
Yeah, it's low.
But this is the possibility.
From neutron.
From neutron, you cannot go to zero close enough.
Probably. And here the scale is not the right.
Okay.
I'm sorry. But the point is, even if these polymers are aggregating with the same kind of structure, these micelles, and have the same kind or same type of organization at the more or less long range, as you see from the structure factor, the rheology, I mean, you can see that from the two systems if being in the tube, the rheology is dramatically different. Mm-hmm. The one end cap are Newtonian fluids, and the telekelic solutions are strongly physical gels. This means that these are these loops which are making the connection between the cores or between the, we have a transient network.
Yeah, so in fact, it's a characteristic time of the viscoelastic liquid which is very different from one to the other. You told us that they are viscoelastic liquids, so they are both viscoelastic liquids.
Uh-uh.
Except that one.
This one is not a viscoelastic liquid. This is a Newtonian fluid. It's like water. You cannot make a difference between a 4%.
Yeah.
It's like water. The other one is a gel. This one is a. But the structure and form factor for the particles are the same.
What's static viscosity?
This is a static viscosity.
What's static?
Zero shear viscosity. And this is obtained by steps. And you see the difference is. 6 or 7 order of magnitude.
If you go up higher concentration, what?
Okay, this phase, this system is making a cubic phase at 8% or 10%. A cubic phase, that we have investigated with neutron and with X-ray, so that was the reason of my comment. And this cubic space is a FCC, definitely. This one is not making a cubic phase at the same at 10%. And probably one of the reasons is that the repulsion is counterbalanced by the attraction due to this to these bridges. So the repulsion is not strong enough. But maybe, I don't know. Or the polydispersity is too big. Probably it's maybe, yeah, polydispersity may be a better argument.
Is it possible to prepare these aggregates in a state where there are no bridges?
Here?
Well, I'm thinking, and then concentrate, or is that just stupid? Yeah. Given this, we think this is because there are bridges between these things, or possibly tangled loops.
Yeah.
If you can prepare them as flowers and then just crunch the flowers up, would you get bridges?
There's a new experiment I heard about from Dave Durrell, where he has polymers that would aggregate, but he can freeze dry them from a dilute enough solution that they aren't bridged.
Yes.
And then when you hydrate it, it takes a substantial amount of time for them to form bridges.
Okay.
So you could actually watch them.
Same relaxation, though. So, I mean, it could be the same relaxation.
It should form with the same time scale as this.
Well, again, I mentioned this very long equilibration time that we observed, tens of minutes. So you could do transient rheology watching it for tens of minutes and it would take that long to shift while we are. People are interested.
So I'm just confused, but Julie was arguing that her main central contribution from the modulus was coming not from the rubber elasticity, but just from the colloidal ordering or whatever.
In this case, everything is coming from the bridges, from the connection.
Connection between two micelles.
Connection between
two. So the picture is somewhat misleading that all the ends go into the center. There are some of the ends hooked up to the next.
Exactly.
Object, the next micelle.
Yeah. So.
Did you actually compare modulus with KT?
I can make a G naught over NKT and I find 1% to 10%, so 0.01 or 2.1.
Okay.
One of the reasons of this. Also with consistent, but of course you have to think that not all our polymers are double end cap. So this plays also a role.
And finally, what about the blue curve if you go up in concentration?
You cannot after that you cannot measure it because the gel you cannot take it and put it in the shearing cell. It's not flowing. Probably there is a yield stress. There is a very strange property there. So you can imagine, for instance, micelles which are connected by several loops which are interconnected. So you have so one short indication also of this is a dye block, and this is a telekelic, and this is a diffusion constant measured by light scattering, and this is a diffusion constant. You see that the second virial coefficient for this one is positive, and for this one is negative. And this is again, and if you calculate what Russell defined as the stickiness or the strength of the interaction, we have something 1 over tau s, which is 6, and the phase separation is expected, according to the Baxter model, for 1 over tau s, larger than 10. So it is consistent. We have attracting micelles and connecting into a transient network. So my point is the following. You look at the literature on transient networks, and this is a very schematical illustration, of course. You have nodes, elastically active chains, and the elastic energy is a sum of all the elastic energy of each strand or each connection integrated over the distribution of the end-to-end distance. The distribution, the end-to-end distance are here. So underlying this, it means that the stress is only coming from the connecting chains. But if you want to put the ingredients of detachment and connection, which is, I mean, the reason why they are viscoelastic fluid and not yield stress system, you need a differential equation to describe the dynamics of connection. And this is one I took from the paper, recent paper of Vaccaro and Marucci, which is the same spirit of the, which is in the same spirit of the originally published by Yamamoto and Yamamoto in the 50s. And what does this equation say? the following. It is the rate of change of this distribution. There is a deformation of the chain, but there is two terms. One is which describes the detachment of the chains from the network, and this one describes the reattachment of the chains to the network. So this is an equation which counts everything as function of time. However, what underlies this approach is that, okay, you have, and you can play, for instance, on this beta of R, which tells you how fast it will disconnect. What underlies this equation is that when you have a flow, because I will speak about nonlinear, you stretch the connecting chain. Because you stretch the connecting chain, they will detach more easily. Okay, and if they will detach more easily, the connectivity of the network will be reduced, and the viscosity will be decreasing. Okay, so the idea is to say that there is a coupling between the flow and the dynamics of the network under flow. Okay, and this approach is fully correct, and this approach describes perfectly, according to me, the linear rheology. And you can.
What's the distinction between psi and phi?
Oh, I'm sorry. No. The psi is the distribution function for the end-to-end distance, and phi is the distribution function for what is called the dangling ends, which are taken into account in this. The dangling ends are the chains which are not connecting to the network. This, and you need, of course, another differential equation for phi. Okay, so all the models are treating these transient networks we are achieving with Telekelix, and these are the predictions by Marucci, playing on these two parameters, beta and alpha. You can have, this is a shear rate, this is a viscosity, and you have the viscosity which has a Newtonian plateau, can have shear thickening and have shear thinning, okay? Playing with these different parameters. My point here is to say that even if this is true for linear rheology, this is not for nonlinear rheology. And there is an additional phenomenon, which is a phenomenon of fracture.
Okay, wait, you're saying shear thinning is not nonlinear
rheology? What I would like to prove is that even if the approach of transient network is valid for the linear rheology, it is not from the nonlinear rheology.
But this is, the calculation is not in nonlinear rheology.
Exactly.
So meaning that their calculation doesn't reflect the reality.
Exactly. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So it does describe some shear thinning, but you think it's not a...
I'm sorry.
Forget about one point. Which
yeah, but which might be important. It's,
yeah.
Which might be important also in the rheology.
Jean-François, how different is this from Tanaka, Edwards?
I think it's the same. I mean, you know, maybe the papers. I think Tanaka Edwards is a recook. How do you say that? The approach of Yamamoto, but I think everything is in Yamamoto for me.
And Marucci is a recook turbos.
But Marucci introduced the differential equation for the dangling ends, which is not, as far as I remember, in the Yamamoto approach. Okay, it's cooking for theory.
You mean it's theory?
It's theory, but it's incredibly powerful because you have elements on which you can place this beta and alpha, no? So according to the old tradition to show viscosity as function of shear rate. I'm sorry. So I had thought about this picture, and you will see that. Okay, this is a viscosity as function of shear rate for two of these systems. And what this is experiment, and the one of the reasons why I plot viscosity versus shear rate is because I'm only interested by this discontinuity. And what happened, you see there's it's constant, there's shear thickening and shear thinning. And if you rescale with the relaxation time, you find that you have the same curve. So my point is to try to show you that in this part, we have fractures.
Just onto the board because
I'm sorry.
Is it a controlled stress experiment?
No.
Controlled shear rate.
After it fractures, do you see bizarre transients in the?
No.
It's just.
So what it means is that once you reach a critical shear rate, the stress jumps down from a value to another one.
Exactly.
In a very narrow range of shear rate.
Well, I think François will show a curve which looks like that on the. And this is discontinuous.
It's a discontinuous.
I will.
Doesn't matter
whether
you plot.
So let's concentrate on this part of the shear thinning regime. On this part of the shear thinning regime at high shear rate, and I put some traces of the viscosity as function of the time that you can rescale again in terms of stress versus strain. And fortunately, or not fortunately, because it belongs to the system, the stress versus strain shows more or less the same curve. More or less, so you see that linear regime, strain hardening, and then a big jump in the stress. Whatever the shear rate, okay? And if you do that, for instance, with step strain experiments of different amplitude, you find again the same picture. And what I
independent of the molecular weight of the tertiary
orbit. Yeah. I mean, this value, this value is not independent.
That is completely inconsistent with what you've got over there.
Oh my God.
You can't say that you have.
No, that's a steady state.
Well, exactly. So, what do you?
Sorry, should I?
They're two completely separate measures, which have nothing to do with each other.
Not as I know.
And you appeared to be somehow relating them between.
I'm sorry. So let's consider the viscosity data as function of time in this range. So I am here in the stress.
So the dots are stationary states.
Always.
Okay. Now you take one dot.
I will take one dot.
Before the.
This dot here corresponds to here.
You take one dot before the transition. Okay.
I take one
and
dot.
You increase the shear rate through the transition. That's not the curve that you show. So what you show is when you start from zero.
That's start of steady shear rate.
Sorry.
That's okay. Just shows the stress overshoot. Yeah. Past the.
Yeah, you go through the transition, through the curve very quickly.
Exactly. I don't go. I am here at this shear rate, and I start the shearing.
Yes.
And the apparatus measures the stress.
Yes.
And I express the viscosity or the stress. That's all.
Does this picture suggest that you have a pseudo plotter here? Because we
all. It's
different. No, it's a different curve. Yeah.
That's time.
Yes.
Yeah, that's time.
But what you are saying is that if you're to the right of that maximum, right, you see this behavior in the start.
Yeah, exactly.
If you go to the left of it, you don't see this.
Exactly.
Right.
It means the curve is as if the curve would continue, but in reality it wants to come down.
What curve? This curve?
The left part. Left part of that curve.
This is sigma as function of gamma dot, huh?
Seems to continue initially.
Yeah. Something like that.
So
exactly.
There's a maximum stress there.
There is a maximum stress.
That's compared to your stress there. Is it 100 pascals? Is it 600 pascals?
What you are trying to compare this value? I don't know.
I know.
Yeah. That's
the blue curve in the middle, correct?
Yeah.
0.05 reciprocal seconds. That to me seems to be to the left, well to the left of that region. So I don't quite understand.
You are right. You are right because you know I have a maniac. I like very much reduced scale. So it is reduced. Shear viscosity, and this is a true shear rate.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to, sorry.
What if you do this on the left
side? I did not want to maybe we will discuss about that later.
You see some rise of some plateau? Or? where you certainly reach
it. It looks like linear viscosity scales, increasingly linear and saturating.
Yeah. Let me continue, otherwise we will. I'm almost finished, but not. So we make the experiment of flow visualization of this system under shear. So we took a system which we know, where we know exactly the rheology, and make flow visualization experiment with using a plates system, where we put, or we, as Pine explained us, we use the natural dust within the viscoelastic solution as tracking particles. It does not play a role. And we are looking here at a certain distance from the rotation axis. And what you see here is the field of our observation as function of time. And each dot is the position of one of these particles. So I start here, and I follow this particle. And on the screen, I have X and Y and so on. And you see that there is here this is they are making a circle. This is, of course, making a circle because everything is rotating. So I will then move. They will move like that on the picture. They seem to be accelerated. So let's look at the distance each particle is doing as function of time, or is the distance that. This is the distance over one trajectory as function of time. At short time here, you see that all the particles, more or less, of the distance which is linear with time. And from this linearity, I can guess a velocity. This is the velocity of the particles. And since you have particles with a low velocity, particles with a high velocity, you can infer to this velocity the height where they are. Because the picture I use is not a good one, because I'm looking particles moving from above, so it's difficult to know where they are. But because the fluid is viscoelastic, with a relatively long time, we can guess what is their height from this initial velocity. At long time, something different happens.
So this is assuming just a constant profile, a constant field rate.
But you can actually move your field of view up and down to check.
Focus.
It's defocus. I see everything. It's a very bad experiment, but it gives nice results.
It's a nice experiment. I like it very much.
So what you see after a given time, these particles which have a slow velocity, so slow velocity means they are low in the sample, they just stop to move. They just remain, and they have no velocity. The distance is constant. So you see these particles not moving in the field. On the contrary, the other one, they are moving further.
What are the different colors?
Different colors is different heights, different particles.
At different heights.
Oh, sorry.
One is green.
Different radii.
So, these are the. Now, this is.
In the graph regulation, the different
the troubles
height.
Are also different radii.
Look here, the picture.
I have a problem with this because it's not.
I don't think you're.
No, because the velocity is a function, even a Newtonian flow is a function of depth and radius in sheared parallel planes.
But you're presumably looking at the range of radius.
The pinhole's what? Which
you're right. You're right.
So you do change that.
Well, it's not.
You are right. I mean, so we have something like 8 centimeters.
Yes.
Okay, 8 centimeters. We have 1.5 millimeter in a. And I'm looking here over 2 millimeters in size.
Yeah,
so I can imagine that for these particles, I've selected the shear rate.
Yeah.
And actually, you are right. The shear rate is not constant. And it gives you an indication about the kinetics of the fracture.
Yeah.
So you see here there is a fracture because the system is split into two parts in some way.
Can I ask again? So are you keeping track of the height or not? So these velocities are just random. There's no correlation between these velocities and the radius. You just
choose. The radius is taken to be almost the same for all of them.
So
yeah.
The only
reason they can be different is these skills are different.
So this is a field of this is 2 millimeters, and this is 2 millimeters, and this is the trajectory of the particles seen from above. Okay, and from the initial state or initial stage, I guess the height where they are. You see, some are moving very slowly, this one, for instance. And this one is moving fast. And this one is moving the faster because it is upper plate. Okay, this is not a particle.
Why are the particles moving slowly and speeding up, or is it reverse? Is it stopping?
You're right. Yeah, this is another expression. Yeah. Good point.
There's something else I missed. So I thought I heard over there that the field of view is 2 centimeters. So over here you're saying it's 2 millimeters. So as a particle crosses this field, it's a strain of 1 approximately.
Let me go to this point. You're right.
Oh, okay.
Because, I mean, what I show is a fracture, but the birth of an inhomogeneous flow. I think I've lost the transparency. But what I like very much in this experiment is, if you now compare this picture where you see this fracture, no, not as function of time, but as function of strain, you see that this is a shear stress, and this is a drop in the shear stress. And that the drop in the shear stress corresponds to the appearance of this non-homogeneous flow. So everything seems to be consistent from the experimental side.
Can you show the other picture that showed the velocity profile as a function of height?
This is a height of the sample, and this is the velocity in millimeter per second. You have slow velocity, but you are right. The picture I show and is related to another
experiment. When you watch a single particle, do you see it jumping back and forth between the two branches?
No. I see particles which are moving slowly and then accelerating a little bit. So you see the fracture is quite broad. Mm. Huh? The zone of fracture is quite broad.
Why do you call that fracture and not shear bending? And we spend days on talking about shear bending, and here you show something which looks like shear bending.
You are right. If you look at the literature about fracture, you see almost only these curves, this type of curves.
Yes.
So meaning that in brittle solids, which are characteristic to have this fracture phenomena, such glasses, you have the force as function of the distance, equivalently the stress as function of the strain. And so you have, most of the time, you can see simulation, you can see experiment. There are people in Israel, they have made the following experiment, taking some piece of copper films, 1 millimeter or half a millimeter, and they have made holes in this piece, this is experiment from the 80s, and they apply the force on this, and they see the fracture as function of the and they get some picture which is a force which increase and then paf.
I think that's the difference. Is when the stress suddenly drops, that's when you have a fracture. In the shear banding experiments, you never see that phenomenon. It's completely different. That's what defines fracture.
In your experiment, do you have two gels sliding?
Exactly.
No, but, okay, rather than a fluid region in which you have a gradient of velocity,
which is very hard to tell.
Exactly.
If you have a fracture in a soft material, you'll have a zone,
It's not. It's
and
not.
You could call that shear banded. Depends exactly on what's happening.
Is there only one of those
jelly
in the flow?
Right? When you make the experiment several times, what you observe is actually not this scenario, which is the most beautiful I got, but you have something which is everything comparable compared to what I've said before, but the flow field is slightly different. The scenario, what I call, is. And in this case, it becomes difficult to say it's a fracture. We have a fracture, in quotes, near the wall. So this is a velocity field after everything. That's the reason why it accelerates. The picture was referring to this. And this result is the one which is the most often observed.
In this case, you would call that
sliding. Or
sliding.
It's very difficult to, but everything looks like in this scenario.
You see, to answer your question, I don't see why when you jump, sigma goes from a finite value to a smaller value violently. It's different from the fact that sigma goes from a given value to a higher value, which is called shear thickening, and where you may eventually have shear bending. You have a transition, in both cases, you have a transition from a value of sigma at a given shear rate from one value to the other.
The only distinction
between a fracture and a shear band is if you think the shear band is so narrow that you're going to call it a singularity.
Yeah, but this the fracture is so broad that it's...
No, it doesn't... I don't know. What do you think? But it's at that point just a matter of language.
Okay.
Surely, a fracture would be, to my mind, the fracture surface would have to have a finite velocity difference across
its fellow surface.
It depends on how broad it is.
Order of the singularity.
That it depends on the geometry of the tool. I mean, if you double the width, you double the effective viscosity.
Yeah.
So it means you have the same slip of a double gap size.
The point about shear banding is there's some sort of coexistence. There's either a coexistence stress or a coexistence strain rate. And in this case, there's neither. And that's what makes the difference.
It's not coexistence?
Well, like you can see the data.
There is a big difference between the micelle and this system, although they are both Maxwellian field. There is the orientation problem. The orientation of the micelles, which are initiated by the starting of the flow. And I think this is one of the difficulty of the micelles. Maybe micelles you can also describe in terms of fracture.
That's what we think.
Yeah. It's a question of language, but it seems to be a very different phenomenon.
This is a problem. I don't know.
The fracture surface has a discontinuity in the velocity and a shear banding. Interface has a discontinuity in the shear rate.
Well, in viscous fracture, you can have a fracture in which the system slips.
Yes,
it does. Because you have to have an infinitely thin region of infinitely high shear rate. That gives you both the discontinuity and the velocity.
So you're saying you have a three-band surface.
Yes,
that's right.
Oh, the shear band. The shear band.
Depends on what you mean by the shear band. I'm talking about a single interface. Where there is two bands.
Then it's totally different, I think.
Well, it's not clear that there are two or three bands.
Yeah.
I don't believe you.
If it's got any bands, it's got three.
Scenario two, yeah, three bands.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't know.
So maybe we can discuss later. But this is the main point. I should not say that. For those who are still skeptic about the fracture phenomenon, it has been found this is a work by what is his first name? McKinley in MIT about extensional flow. This is the same kind of polymers, telekinetic HEUR, and you see here when they elongate the system. The result is completely different from classical polymers.
Yeah.
You don't have.
Well, my micelles do that as well.
This is in solution or in air?
Interesting.
It's in air.
But what you should notice is that the deformation is 2,
yes.
Exactly as in the experiment I show you. So for me, even if this is fracture is probably an important feature in the system. So I stop. But I agree. The question is about
when you after the fracture happens, when you increase the shear rate,
why can't we continue?
Because exactly the same type of fracture.
So, it's a good point in being the last to speak that people are saying many these important things about trending networks they will have to tell again.
And you get the final word.
Well, I don't have a final word.
There's a laser thing
on
there. Just don't turn it.
Turn it?
No, it's a little button, a little tiny button. Circle button.
Good!
Yeah.
You have to hold it continuously.
Or only when you want to point.
Okay.
Not in GI,
In fact, the system I'm going to speak about is slightly different. So we're starting Montpellier roughly at the same time when we began to have these telekinetic polymers available in fact, implementing a real system, the ideas of Green and Tobolsky, been working on this theoretical concept of transient networks and applying it to semi-denuded solutions and polymers from the 40s. But now with telekinetics, you can do it. And in fact, we want to understand the micelles, and that's the reason why we do that. But here, instead of binary system quadrant electrics, for something different, Clegg Porte and Jacqueline Appel were working on microemulsion of small oil droplets in water. And the idea was to add these telekinetics to this microemulsion to create a trend. And you have basically all the things which have been said before apply. You have the two stickers of telekinetic can be on the same micelle creating loops, or can create elastic bridges between micelles. And we have also a phase diagram. So what are the important ingredients in this system? You have the density, the volume density of your nodes, the droplets, and what we call, well, which is improperly called the connectivity of the network, which is just the number of stickers per droplet. So in our phase diagram, we have the volume concentration of droplets on this, and here the average connectivity. And in fact, in this picture, all the things which have been said apply again. If you have low volume fraction, you increase the connectivity, you have a biphasic. You separate into a liquid, let's say a dense phase of droplets. And if you do the interesting thing that when you do neutrons, when you do X-rays, you will see only the droplets. You can see either the corona or the oil inside, as you like. And so when you increase the connectivity, you phase separate into a liquid dense phase with a given distance between the droplets and a sort of gas phase in suspension. And moreover, you have another line beside the phase separation line, you have another one which is quite interesting. It is in this high concentration region, you have a percolation line, which separates a point where the system is a liquid, basically, and a system where it begins to exhibit on a reasonable time window an elastic modulus, an instantaneous modulus. So what I want to show now is just to give you an idea of the typical distances that we are speaking about. So you see an example. I will forget to tell you at the end. This is work we've initiated by Grégoire Porte and Jacqueline Appel, and most of the results of biology I will present now from Eric Michel's thesis. And the results were more concerned with experimental with theory and simulations are from the PhD of Jean Kiefer.
Sorry, just before you go on, you indicated size actually for these droplets, which is controlled. You created them all.
Yeah, in macromotion. Perhaps this second slide.
Can I explain more?
This second slide. So, with using surfactant and cosurfactant, you control the curvature.
Okay.
And so you can obtain very monodisperse microemulsions. So, you start from the microemulsion, decay. So, we have two systems, CPCL octanol, T100, T35. You add your polymer, which are very similar, PUO, with twice substituted at the ends. So, for at a typical volume fraction of 8%, I fix, give you some ideas of distances. Diameter of the droplets 120 angstroms, distance between the surfaces roughly 100 angstrom, and Jacqueline, Grégoire, and Eric have been using C12, C18 stickers, so longer stickers, because here we are in oil, we are not creating this dense aggregate of the stickers, so it's easier for them to get out, and we are using longer ones to have long times of relaxation, and the typical radius of duration of the polymer is 35 angstrom. These 10 kilopolymers. Okay? So I'll give you some structural data, but the comments will be very, very similar to the ones that have been made previously. Okay, so the question one could ask, which has led to a lot of discussion, is what is the contribution of the repulsion of the corona to the elasticity? And in this system, like in the Jean-François system, I think we can claim that the repulsion, the influence of the repulsion is quite weak, and that we can begin to play with simple models of this system starting from Tanaka-Eagle's like picture. So here you have, as a function of volume fraction, the distance between spheres. So what you see then, when you have a high volume fraction, when you decrease the volume fraction, you increase the distance between spheres, and if you have only polymer which are half this one, with only one extremity substituted and half the length, you continue to increase the distance in a way which is very similar to what you predict theoretically for sample volume arguments. If you have the stickers, you have at a given point you begin to saturate to a given distance which is typical of the dense phase. And we have been doing a lot of rheology here around in this region. And here I'll show you structural data precisely in this region, to show that when you have 5K PEO one substituted polymers, you have, when you increase the connectivity, you have a small sharpening of the peak, almost no sharpening of the peak when you are twice substituted. And a last piece of evidence I must mention, just to confirm, to argue that we can start to think about this as a network, a random network of springs, and not take into account the repulsion in this system, is that when you're working in the percolated region at this concentration, the droplets covered by the monofunctional polymer, it's a liquid. You will never see any elasticity. So in no shear modulus, let's say. I'm sure that the corona contribute to the osmotic pressure, but to the shear modulus, there seems to be absolutely no contribution. So our picture was to try to understand this system in a Tanaka-Edwards-like way. And of course, it's a Maxwell fluid. And what I'm going to do is work. So what I'm going to do is work in the rheology in this region of the phase diagram. So I'll be very far from the phase separation. I think I've been doing a lot of work to see what happens to the rheology, to the light diffusion, to the dynamic light scattering. When you go closer to the phase separation, I will concentrate on describing what happens in the region, which is very far. And in this line, when you add the polymer, basically you do not change the distance between the droplets. You do not really phase separate, because they are at the right distance from the beginning, if you want, yeah. Okay? So, it's a Maxwell fluid, as you can expect. For small applied strain in a step strain experiment, you have a slightly stretched exponential, so this is a linear one I want to describe, and you have only two quantities to describe it, the typical time, tau, and the modulus G0. And see if you have this nice phase diagram in which you can play independently on R and phi. On a given phi, you can play with R and look at the dependence on the relaxation time and G naught over R. And these are the pictures. When you decrease the connectivity, your instantaneous elastic modulus and your typical relaxation time goes to zero, like some power.
So R is what the ratio?
The number of stickers per droplet. Okay, what we call the connectivity. I must mention that we have no idea of the ratio of loops versus bridges. We don't. We assume that it's not changing too much in this region, but we really have no idea. Okay?
The number of stickers or the number of polymers?
Sorry?
Your distances between are not changing.
Yeah.
Is it the number of stickers or the number of polymers?
Of stickers.
Oh, okay. So you take one
polymer. So we have to take the same measure as Russell. Okay. And so this power law behavior, I have written the word percolation. Well, I don't think this power law behavior has anything to do with some kind of fractal structure of the network, something like that. We are here very far from any percolation. Here, perhaps, very near the threshold, you can argue in terms of percolation networks and all that, but here we have certainly very dense networks. But nevertheless, an important point is that when you, I'm not sure it's such an important point, but what we tried to do is to understand the paper of Tanaka and Edwards. And so, and that's the reason we are doing experiments.
I mean, that's a reason, but that's not the only one.
Something which is clear is that when you decrease the connectivity, you lose elasticity more rapidly than if it was linear. Okay? And when you look at the paper on transient networks, in fact, it was not so easy to us, or perhaps for people who work on networks, it's obvious, how to piece together percolation behavior and Maxwellian behavior. We didn't find it so trivial. Because the usual argument, in many of the analytical models on transient networks, it's very difficult to do something else than an homogeneous deformation. And of course, most of people say, what people write in terms of the elastic modulus, is that the elastic modulus is proportional to the density of ridges. And Now I must turn to the way, and that's what Jean-François has explained. How does the system relax stress?
Is it obvious?
No, it is not. But it is what people write. But it is not obvious.
It's not obvious.
But that's, you know, it's very difficult to write something else. When you're writing a theoretical paper, when you want to apply when you do a step strain experiment, what you do is you homogeneously deform the network.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it will appear eventually, even if it's quite homogeneous. The weak parts will break first. In any case, okay. So. Let's try, for me, it was quite a rather subtle argument, and I'll try to summarize it. All the people pictures relaxation of the stress. So you have your initial distribution of polymers, of bridges. You shear it a little bit, and you deform it. And then you cut your bridges, and you recombine them in an isotropic way. So you have two populations, let's say very roughly. So population of the bridges which have not yet been cut, and the isotropic population. And what people say is that you can forget about the one which have been cut once, because they are reforming in an isotropic way. So the number of bridges at time t you should take into account is exponentially decaying. And if your modulus is proportional to the density of bridges, your modulus is exponentially decaying. And this gives you Maxwell behavior, okay? And this is a classical argument. G is proportional to the number of bridges, so it's L in our case. The number of bridges, elastic bridges still active, is exponentially decaying. So we expect a Maxwell behavior. But when you do simulations, you observe that something...
So you don't expect the nodes to move?
Yes, that's the problem. Because if you allow the nodes to move, you do not make enough information. And that's the point.
Yeah.
And of course, when you don't allow the... when Grégoire Porte gave a talk about this topic in SPC in Paris, Tony Max pointed out that if you try to piece out together this behavior with an exponential relaxation of the number of this classical argument, of course, everything is going very badly. In fact, you lose population in a finite time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, but when you think about it, it's obvious. You're not assuming the needs to move.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that if the system is Maxwellian, it's because of the elastic relaxation of the bridges. If you allow the system to reach at every time elastic equilibrium, you recover the Maxwellian behavior. But it means that even in the linear regime, the reason of the Maxwellian behavior is non-trivial. And if you do it in a simulation, it's pretty well convincing. Here I show two simulations in which you allow the system to relax, or it's two-dimensional, so I don't want to claim that you have any kind of clear fit with any of the data, of course. You take 10,000 particles in a two-dimensional random network, and you do your Monte Carlo kinetics of cutting and recombining, or not. In fact, when you don't allow the droplets to move, you don't even have to recombine it because you don't use it. And if you allow it to, you don't allow it to recombine, you recover this, and you don't have the percolation behavior, by the way, because of course, when you in this picture, even if you have two droplets alone in the middle of nowhere, if you shear it in an affine way, you keep the elasticity. So you don't have the percolation behavior, and you recover simultaneously using the elastic relaxation a Maxwell-like behavior and the percolation behavior. So this, I'm not sure this is a very important point, but just help us to imagine that even in the linear regime where everything appears very simple, it's not obvious. You should let the system do what it wants. Okay, and it also gives a hint about the non-linear reality, because in non-linear reality, when you're shearing it quite fast, is the system able to relax elastically? And will not this be an important piece of part of the argument? Okay, so enough for the linear, and I turn to the non-linear reality. So in step strain, it manifests itself as a sharp drop in the modulus, followed by a second, and this is quite well explained by Tanaka Edwards, because you stretch some ridges very big, very bigly, a great stretch, and these are broken very fast, and then you come back to the ones which are still in this state, basically. Okay. As the one which are highly stretched. Because in the Tanaka Edwards experiment point of view, as in the Yamamoto one, he was the first to point that, you have an exponential contribution of the tension of the chain to the probability of the rupture. Okay. And now I turn to the flow curve. So this is the stress versus shear rate I was mentioning, and also the black dot. So you have. It's not very clear because
should have enhanced this path. So you have a linear behavior. We don't observe any shear thickening, except when you go closer to the line, when you go closer to the biphasic region, you begin to see it. But in this region I'm speaking about, 10%, you don't see it. And then you have this quite bizarre behavior. I must insist on one point. These points are all steady state. That is, you go there, then you have very long transients. It goes down there, so transients like that, just like in the mice. It takes a very long time to relax from a point here to a point here in a shear rate. And if you go down, you come back here. Okay? Of course, this and the visual observation of Jean-François, and the fact that this depends on the geometry suggests a fracture, actually, I think.
How upon strain rate do transients persist?
I think here you don't see anything anymore. It's very special. Mm-hmm. It's unfair. Okay, so this is a dependence on the angle of the cone, in fact. But here I'm cheating a little bit because we discovered that we have in our two different systems we have two different because there's something quite puzzling here. You reach a stress, and you expect it to be a fracture. So when you reach a stress, basically you have reached a stress when the local weak points of the gel begins to break. So you drop, and what happens when you reach the same fracture again? You expect it to break another point. So you expect to have another event of fracture somewhere here, and you don't understand why this thing goes up, by the way. And for this system, we discovered that in fact it was a boundary fracture. And that's the reason why it goes up. And between our two surfactants, one of the system is sleeping as a boundary systematically, and the other one do not. And the only difference is the surfactant and co-surfactant. This is quite mysterious, but.
And when it does not, what happens?
Actually. So it becomes highly irreproducible after the first fracture. This is.
Uh-huh.
So go up. So I put these lines, which are not very useful, but just to. So this is quite reproducible, but then other events of the same kind begin to appear. It's extremely difficult to obtain reliable points in this mm-hmm. region. So the impression we have, you have when you do some a lot of experiments, is that you have successive events, but discrete events of fracture taking place in material.
How is the signal as a function of time?
Is it transients?
Each point here you get really a stationary state.
Yeah, but it's not reproducible.
It's interesting, the fact that the stress does increase again though, it says that the two fractured surfaces are talking to each other. I mean, there is stress transmission across.
Yes, of course. Only because you have the fluid in any case.
Well, so what's your picture? That you have a thin fracture zone in which you just have a kind of a thing like a clutch consisting of Newtonian fluid.
I would say, in fact, I'm not even sure you can see the system as a one-dimensional system with refracture. We think what I will argue afterwards is an important point is the tip. And in fact, the whole vision in shear banding in the micelles and the microemulsion as a one-dimensional system could break down.
So this is going back.
This is going to break, yes.
What do you mean by the tip?
The tip of the fracture. You say one dimensional.
But I mean, by the time but say you're doing it in Couette.
Yeah.
You have a tip while the fracture is forming, but then it presumably propagates all the way around, and you don't have a tip.
Well, because as Paul told us, thus in these systems, healing processes at the same time.
Okay, so you said
some competitions are occurring.
Fracturing and healing going on at once.
Yes, that's what
is perfectly possible.
Well, that's what we think. And in fact, we even think that, and I show you the flow curve to very high shear rates now, for different connectivities. And we found this picture extremely interesting. Oh, this is a stable region we're speaking about. And afterwards, when you go to high shear rates, what you have is a regime in which basically the slope is always the same. And this comes to a piece of evidence which interests us. I'm not sure it is such an important key, but it is a fact that you can always look at it as some kind of a slope extrapolating, but not to zero, a Bingham. And the fact that this slope is so constant, and it's very close. Okay, I must mention that this slope is not so far from the one you would expect, the one we have for the 5K system. The system without the bridges.
Okay. So this slope is what you expect from a system without the bridges, roughly. So it means that inside the fracture, you could picture it as you have broken locally the bridges, and you have only the droplets covered with loops going around.
But there was no, wait a minute.
Okay.
But that wouldn't give you that slope. I mean, that would give you that slope if that was happening everywhere, not just inside a fracture.
Exactly. But is that what you, yes, but the difference between the two situations is that this would extrapolate to zero, basically. And we think that the fact it does not extrapolate to zero indicates that the system is always creating and destructing this fluid phase.
Well, that's okay, but it's still that picture still requires it to be a uniform flow.
In the fracture.
No. Right. If you were, say the fracture is 10% of the width of the material, then that slope should be 10 times higher than the slope for the 5.
But we think that the density of fracture do not change anymore here.
No, but the density of fracture in the 5 case is 100% in this picture, because like you're saying, it's like that.
No, because in this system you don't have to create it.
I know, but in that sense, in the 5K case, you don't have any of these links to break. The whole material is flowing in this way.
Yes.
What you're saying now is only flowing a small proportion of the material in the fracture. And to get that slope.
I don't know the proportion.
Yeah, but it has
to be 100%, otherwise that slope would be multiplied by 1 over the ratio
between the two. Okay, I agree. It's a very big part of the sample.
Offset is a separate issue, I agree.
Yes, but this indicates that the system has to create it all the time. Okay.
But the issue of the local strain rate, this is the average strain rate in the device.
Yeah.
You, to know the viscosity of that material in the fracture, you have to know the local strain rate.
You're right.
So this complicates the material. Maybe these two things
compensate.
It's
because there's always a relation between those slopes until you know the amount of fracture you've got.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it's possible, or at least from what I understand, it's not impossible, that effectively 100% of your sample is fractured.
But it's always healing.
No, I understand. But coming back to this notion of fracture, here you have a system that maybe when you are at 100, 1000 second minus one, all your sample is in fact in the fracture region.
Right. Yes, right.
Not though.
Right, but it's not viscous.
No, it's got a bigger offset.
No, I understand. But because...
That's your point.
Yeah, but in this case, coming back to what you call fracture,
I mean,
okay.
This extrapolation seems to indicate that, well, perhaps you could say that it's not really meaningful to extrapolate, but if you have a part of your stress, which is constant, it means that you pay something in proportion to the distance you move.
Yeah.
And this means, and in a fracture picture, you can understand it. And in fact, this kind of behavior, we have it systematically in the ordered phase we have studied. And in the ordered phase, you can understand it. When you have a cubic phase, even in the layer sliding, and you want to move it from here to here, whatever the speed, you must go do n time the movement on the valley. So you have a part of the stress which must be constant. But here, it's very, for me, how to it was not easy for us to imagine a process, this kind of disorder and not so dense system, which would leads to Bingham fluid. To have something which is paid in proportion to the distance is not easy. And we think that the fracture issue could be an answer. But this indicates that in the ICO branch of this system, you have a highly fracturated material that you cannot understand as a one-dimensional one.
Do you see stress fluctuations in time?
Yeah.
No, in this region, not very much.
No.
Here, yes, but here, not very much. No. Okay.
And we also have I want to speak about a model which is not related to fracture. Question is, we try to do some one-dimensional simulations to see if we could understand this Bingham behavior from very simple simulation. We have two plates moving. This is not a fracture picture. You have two plates moving, and you have your polymers trying to reconnect to the upper one, or creating loops. They recombine with the Gaussian probability and they break in a way which is proportional to their tension. And if you do that, what you observe that you have an elastic stress, but this elastic stress for high shear rate goes to zero. So even if you add a viscous flow on top of that, you will still have eventually something which is viscous at high shear rate. So in fact, the issue could be to
If you like to interpret this as a viscous part plus some elastic part which is unstable, the issue is to find an elastic behavior which for high shear rate will not go to zero. And it's not so easy, because if you do it naively like that, it will go to zero. Okay? So we think that, but in this system, of course, you do not allow the stress to concentrate on the tip of the fracture. And when you allow the system to concentrate, the stress to concentrate on the tip of the fracture, you've got this part of the energy you pay to open the lips of the fracture of a given distance. And this should lead to a beam gap behavior.
Okay, we have a model, an analytical model, which, I think it's not, I like to discuss a bit with Michael about this model because it's quite close to what he has done on shear thickening, but I think my last slide was just to try to say, shall we think about the meissens in the same way? Well, it's not very usual to plot the meissen curve like that, and this is, do not look at it like a straight line. But from this data, Jean-François pointed out to me was that when you try to look at the Meissner behavior as some kind of unstable elasticity plus even a weak power of the fluid, in general, it doesn't really work. So is it not possible that even in the Meissner, we must understand this high shear branch as something not extrapolated here, and thus, again, in this system, for a far more ductile material, the transient microinversion could be a fragile material, and the Meissner a ductile material. Could we understand this in terms of a high shear branch of the micellar system being a highly fracturized one? Because from the experiments I have been describing, that I have heard of during this talk, I understand now that I'm not very familiar with micelles, but the structure of the sample in the high shear branch now is very obscure. Mm-hmm. And the guess, could it be that in describing it in a one-dimensional way, we are in the wrong direction? And you cannot ignore the fact that the system is always healing in the kind of mechanism Paul has described, and the precise microscopic mechanism of this healing could be the propagation of fronts of fracture, very heterogeneous in the material in the high shear branch. Okay, so I just stop here. This is very speculative, for example, but I think we should perhaps look in this direction. Thank you.